Hello, welcome to First Impressions, the podcast where we talk about our love for Jane Austen and give a big middle finger to all the haters. I am Kristen and I'm joined by Maggie.
Hi.
And today we're going to talk about the 1999 movie adaptation of Mansfield Park, written and directed by Patricia Rosema. And it's a big one, right, Maggie?
I actually cannot believe we haven't talked about it before. I had like a really clear memory that we'd talked about it before. I searched all our old episodes to try and confirm if we'd talked about it before. And maybe you and I have just talked about it off mic. That must have been it. Like you and I, just because we talk about Jane Austen stuff, even when we're not recording, that must have been it. Because I could have sworn that we talked about it.
I knew we hadn't because it's kind of my white whale. And I knew I wasn't going to be able to do a good job and I was going to be too negative. And I have a lot to say today because I feel like I've really evolved and I've grown and I have a way of looking at this where it was beneficial to watch it again and it was meaningful and I did get something out of it. And I have to revise my prior opinions live on air, like that joke, like, are you loudly wrong in public or do you not have a podcast?
Kristen, that's so good for you though, that you're so growing good. And love that journey for you.
Love that for me. Well, I used that's to think so about all the angry things I would say about this. And then I thought, you know, it would be funny if we did a podcast about it, but I could only say nice things. But now I don't even need those guardrails because I can just say even-handed things. And I think that I just grew so much through the gauntlet of adaptations that we've had in the 2020s.
You know, the other terrible Mansfield Park adaptation.
Now, we talked about that one, and that one really yes. Okay. So let's start. First impressions, and I will let you go first. Just overall.
Oh, okay.
What did you think?
I think that as a romantic historical drama, comedy, drama, whatever. As a historical costume movie, it was good and fun, and I enjoyed it a whole lot. I think as a Mansfield Park adaptation, it fails. But that's because, and I know you're going to talk about this, and I know we've talked about this before, the classic problem of being like, well, Fanny sucks, so I'm just going to make Fanny Jane Austen. I will, however, say that I think it makes a better movie. Oh, but it's still a terrible, it's still a terrible adaptation, but it's a better movie.
And just to riff on that, Maggie, so I have been thinking about this so much and I have so many notes on this. And, you know, Rosema made this choice, right? And she had reasons that I don't love or agree with. But one of the things that we're going to have to reckon with today is that Austen was trying to critique the English gentility, right? Slave owners. And there's some question as to how or why or what are the methods or what she thought, blah, 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 blah. We're going to get into all of it. But I started to wonder, can Fanny be seen in some sense, because she's so silent, as an avatar for the reader? So while Fanny is sitting by watching, the reader is also sitting by and just watching and absorbing what everyone is doing. And Austen, as the author, is doing satire. So I don't think from that perspective, when we make a movie, that we need a silent auditor in the room, because we, the viewers, are that auditor.
Right.
And we could have a voice, you know, alongside us, giving us that wry wit, which we do sometimes to good effect, sometimes to what I didn't think was successful. But from that standpoint, and Rosema did describe her choice as prismatic, right? You're seeing Mansfield Park through the prism of the author's eyes, Jane Austen's eyes, is what she was trying to do. So is it a bad choice for a movie? I'm with you. I don't think it makes no sense.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, we've talked about this when we've talked about Mansfield Park, the novel. It's very difficult to adapt a character like Fanny because everything is so internalized. And in the novel, you kind of get that because they can just tell us. But unless you want to have a lot of voiceover or things like that, it's just very difficult. It's a different medium. It's very difficult to do it. as far as the critiquing and mentioning the slave trade, I think that the film gets a few points for engaging in a theme that most films set in this time and place don't even bother to do, which is that all of this wealth is basically based on the back of colonialism, right? It's all, the wealth all comes from the exploitation of other peoples and basically the rape of their cultures and their the actual people. And so I give it points for engaging with that. But I think, again, it fails in just, you can't just engage with that on the surface. It's too much and it's too important. I feel like you either make a movie about that or you don't do this, like, well, we're just going to like dip our toe in and mention it, because then it's kind of like, you're not doing enough. Like this is, it makes it almost worse. I don't know. This is very rambling. You've thought about it more than I have, so I'm interested to see what your thoughts are.
Rosamund deserves a lot of credit for this swing for the fences, but then she stumbles in the same way we stumble when we try to read the book that way, in that the book does not have a conclusion that's neatly packaged, satisfying, clear, a way forward to break free from systemic injustice and divorce yourself from that morally. There's no answer there. And as one critic put it, I think it was the Los Angeles Times reviewer at the time said, Rosamund is so embarrassed by the ending of this movie. It's almost like she's embarrassed to film it. And then she keeps repeating, it could have happened a different way, but it didn't. And, yeah. I just wasted my time. It's just, because it's like, okay, this is really, really important. But I think that the slavery subtext in Mansfield Park, sometimes it evades modern readers for a number of reasons. Our lack of very deep historical context and knowledge of how the people of the time would have read that. And so I tried to dig deep, deep into the scholarship on this. At least that was my plan. I was planning to read everything I could about the slavery subtext in Mansfield Park. I did spend the last 3 days trying to do my homework. I got very behind.
I think no one's going to blame you, Kristen.
I was helped out a lot by some fantastic literature reviews and some fantastic references, and then just doing a lot of reading of reviews of the movie and interviews with Rosma to figure out where we are. First of all, where are we with slavery and with the book? And then,
can I just interject something really quick?
Go, please.
I just want to point out that I think it's a very fair critique of the source material to say that Jane Austen was not an expert on the slave trade and the slave-based economy. Like, we can all agree that's true, right?
So Austen did some very in-depth reading. She read Clarkson, who's an author mentioned in the movie as well. His treatise on... the title of his treatise is very long, but it's like on slavery and in particular the African
slaves. I mean, that's fine, but like, I think just by her place and the limitations that she was facing, like, she's not an expert. And
let me restate what I think you're trying to say is that it would be unfair to expect Jane Austen to feel the immediate urgency of the implications of slavery, like having not been
No,
there.
That's not what I'm saying, actually.
Oh, okay.
What I'm saying is that the same problem the movie has is a similar problem the novel has, that it is not an in-depth enough look at what was happening, and it lacks full understanding of what was happening to go into it. And I'm not, none of this is Jane Austen's fault. Like, I'm not saying she should have done her research. Like, do your own research, Jane Austen. This is just, I don't know how much anybody who wasn't actually involved in it at the time could have been fully understanding the complicated nature of all of this. And so I just see a lot of, and I just saw this in a movie last night, in fact, I see a lot of costume dramas and things like that, where people, and we've talked about this before, people try to draw parallels between white women being stuck in marriages or having limited options and people who are literally enslaved. And as I get older, I just have less patience for it. So if that helps clarify kind of where I'm coming from, that's where I'm coming from.
You know, we
those
do-
kind of those kind of when people try to compare those two situations, like I'm not saying that women who obviously lived back then with their limited means and limited options, it wasn't terrible. But when people try to draw it to like being literally enslaved, it just really bothers me. So that was a long tangent. I'll let you go back.
No. I was going to come to a similar conclusion whereas as modern readers and modern watchers, right? It doesn't have a lot to illuminate and it has a lot to go backwards, you know, where these two things were linked and they were linked historically in that, like, if you read Wollstonecraft's, like, The Vindication of the Rights of Women, for example, like she's drawing some parallels there with slavery because these kind of ideas were happening at the same time. And, right. And was it ludicrous? Yes, it was ludicrous. You know, even then it was, but it was riding like a wave of thought or like a, I'm expressing this wrong, but I am no scholar.
I totally understand what you're saying. Yeah.
But you know, there were interesting things going on then, and we have to see this in that prism. I will say Austin was likely really aware of the realities of slavery because during that time, abolition, there was a ton of abolitionist literature published, very graphic descriptions of the slave trade, and it almost became kind of like a cause du jour, mm-hmm. To the point where people felt like it might have been even a little oversaturated. And then there's the economic element of it. So I think at one point, and anyone who's really interested in what Austin would have known should read this. Marcus Wood is the most recent chapter I read, Cannons to the Right of Them, Cannons to the Left of Them, Mansfield Park, Jane Eyre, and Memorial Subversions of Slavery, which delves into the economic understanding of slavery. And I believe Adam Smith comes up at one point, but it's like this, when Sir Thomas comes home from Antigua, and this is the famous thing that we all catch on to, right, where he looks at Fanny, he looks at her body, he starts talking about how much she's improved.
Right.
It's all physical. Like he's thinking of her as another thing he owns. I mean, he has invested into her. There's many times during the book where he's like, it's not undesirable for me to be relieved from the burden of her expense. And then when he comes home, he's like, oh, I can make some money off of this chick. And that's of course what Austin's always trying to illustrate in all of her books is how women, you know, and this challenge that they face. Right.
I think that is a good example of how it like actually does make sense.
It does and make sense, but is also ludicrous? Yes.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah. it just makes me think of like a good example of this not happening is from the Ong Lee Sense and Sensibility adaptation when we get the conversation between Eleanor and Hugh Grant, because he'll just always be Hugh Grant. But when he's talking about like, oh, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do. And I've got, you know, this is like a second son, like what? And she's like, okay, you have options. Like there are zero options for me, but this is a good, like, these are two people who are of a similar station. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's a good way of doing that. That doesn't come off as just kind of like, okay. I am also clearly not a scholar because I don't know how clearly I'm expressing what I feel, but, I just think it's really difficult. And one of the interesting things I think about reading more historical works of fiction too, is you have to remember the time and place. And so perhaps I'm being too harsh, but it's just something that occurred to me. And it only really came to me because we watched the movie Chevalier last night. Have you seen that?
No.
It was very good. I really wished it had been better. I don't know if I'd say it was very good. It's about a man, it's based on a true story, a man who was born of a like white landowner and an enslaved woman, but he's a violin virtuoso. And his father actually takes him to France. It's right before the French Revolution. And he becomes like just one of the most talented fencers and violin players in the entire country. He's elevated to the rank of chevalier, which is basically like a knight, by Marie Antoinette. And he, in the film, which I don't think this is really based on anything, he engages in an affair with a married white woman who has like implied abusive husband. And she's talking to him about how she feels so trapped and like there's nothing she can do and all of these things. And she just, cause she wants to be an opera singer. So she's talking to the black man who is like alone in this country where he is not allowed to marry a white person. And if he marries a Black woman, he would lose his title. And he's just like trying to straddle these two worlds and be, and, you know, elevate himself. And she's like, and I want to be an opera singer. And it just made me have that same feeling. I mean, don't get me wrong. Her husband was a total asshole. And I understand like how awful that must have been, but it's just that same kind of parallel.
Well, literally, this also happens in Mansfield Park with the actual words, I'm trapped or I cannot get out. And the movie and the book also, the movie also references this, right? Lawrence Stern's A Sentimental Journey Through France and England or something, where it's the starling, I cannot get out. I actually went and read this passage, and it's about, as it says in the movie, a person who's trying to free a bird from a cage who keeps saying, I can't get out. Mm-hmm. And then if you read the actual book, it goes into a very explicit meditation on slavery. Mm. So this is literally what this is. And here we have Mariah saying, oh no, I'm trapped in a marriage to a rich man, poor me. Right. So it's this conflation. But here's the interesting thing that I meditated on a lot today. So I have been really hard on this movie for being ham-handed, for taking a book that's about people who believe they're good people, who slowly, who ignore major flaws in their reasoning or major flaws in the way that they, you know, even live, are turning away from the fact that they live on the exploitation of human beings. And this happens from through various people. So Sir Thomas, you know, he sees himself as a good person, right? And that's what's so interesting about the book, is the character study of these people who see themselves as good. And it's this distorted mirror. Mm-hmm. And this movie is very ham-handed in that it makes a lot of people, you dislike them right away, like with a line or, you know, oh, Mary Crawford, she seems kind of vixenish. She's a bad person, or, you know, like, but one thing that I gave it less credit for than I should have is that this movie does something very interesting with Sir Thomas, where he does get the sympathetic moments, the same way he does in the book. He does get moments where he seems decent, where he seems nice, where he seems to truly love Fanny, and then turns on a dime. And apparently what Rosma said is, when she did her homework, right? She did all of this reading. And the reason she wanted to make this movie is she wanted to have the scene where Sir Thomas comes upon Fanny looking at the sketchbook of Tom's work, mm-hmm. depicting him and the horrors of what he was doing. And then he, you know, has this reaction. He denies it. My son is mad. He rips the book. Yeah. Right. He doesn't want to look at it. And then he goes and he's like agonized next to the fire, you know, like he's
ashamed, right?
He's morphing. Yeah. He's ashamed, and he's morphing from someone who believes that he is a good person who's trying to raise his daughters right, to a person who's literally living off this exploitation and this torn identity. And I just thought that was the point at which I thought there was something valuable in bringing that element so literally into the movie so that we could have that. However, I think, and this is the way I'm coming to see the book too, is that this book is Austin trying to challenge Sir Thomas a lot. That I know we see Fanny as like a complicit white woman, but when we see Fanny's choices, she is never in a position of power.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is kind of the better parallel. Like, you don't compare Fanny to someone else who is enslaved, but you just show like she doesn't have any power to change anything around her.
Right. Well, now in a modern context, we would say, if this is so morally abhorrent, Fanny, why are you choosing Edmund over Henry? Edmund is literally assuming the role of his father in the household. He also sexualizes you in the same way Sir Thomas does, you know, like you're physically talking about your body. She had a way out. And the movie, through Henry Crawford, who, while he does exploit English labor, doesn't have any like ties to the slave trade that we know of. But that's a moral decision too, because then she's deciding to just use someone's wealth and money to escape another situation. And the movie actually kind of plays with this. It spends a lot of time in the second half talking about how Henry Crawford can free her from a number of different types of captivity. Yeah. And when he sends her that thing with all the birds that fly out, the kid says, I was supposed to say something about a starling.
Yeah.
Right. She has to be freed from her family obligations. He wants to explicitly free her from her love of Edmund, which he sees as, you know, completely pointless. And, you know, from out from the people trying to control her with wealth, the Mansfield family generally. And I thought that was really interesting.
I'm not sure. I have two things I want to mention. First, I'm not sure the movie does a good enough job, honestly, of showing us, the viewer, why Henry is so untrustworthy until the very end.
Yeah.
That's kind of like a big flaw for me watching it. I was like, what is the problem? Like, you saw him flirt with Mariah, but he's like a 24-year-old dude. Like, what is the problem, Fanny? Is she just really projecting because she just really loves Edmund that much? So like, nobody will ever be good enough. It's not clear. They needed to show some more like blatant bad stuff from him, to make it believable.
Where the movie fails at portraying Mansfield Park, the book, is just the unforgivable excisement of the entire set piece of Lover's Vows, more or less. Because to me,
unforgivable. There's blackface.
Yeah, I know, right?
But you know what? Like, I'm not going to say it's okay because it's never okay. But it's Tom, and like, Tom's an asshole. So like, I could see Tom doing that. Do you know what I mean? It's not like Johnny Lee Miller came out with that. You're already supposed to. And I actually do really like how the film, I think when Tom, I mean, he's drunk when Fanny shows up when he's like 15 years old or whatever. But when he comes back from traveling with his father, there's an obvious change in how kind of wild he is. And for me, and maybe just because I really love James Purfoy, I like want to read this into the performance. It was a clear like reaction to the horrors he saw. He is burying himself in like drinking and gambling. And he doesn't want to think about what he saw.
There's so many things that I want to say, and I don't want to forget. So let me talk about Lover's Vows and we go back to Tom.
Okay. Cause I still have to say the second thing that I wanted to say.
Okay. Good. You go first. You're going to forget it.
The second thing I want to say, and you can pick up right with the play. The second thing I wanted to say is just that, in case anyone thinks I'm judging any of these characters too harshly, the way to engage with this, I think that would have been really interesting, is to show how Fanny doesn't have any power to change these things around her. Like, she starts to learn that all of this wealth comes from the exploitation of people, but what can she do? It's just like us. This country is also built on a slave economy. It's just not here. It's in Asia. Like, every time I go to Target, I know what I'm doing. This is why I can order something from an online like drop shipment place in China and it costs me $10. But like, what are my options as this one consumer? Do you know what I mean? I don't have any individual power to completely restructure the American economy. And so I think that would have been an interesting thing to explore, because that's the world that we live in now. And so I just wanted to make that point in case people thought that I was being a total hypocrite or something like that. I mean, I am a total hypocrite, right? We all are, but this is the way our current economy is structured. We've just outsourced it all across the ocean again. So I just wanted to, I think that's an important point to make. And I think that you could make this story really relevant.
I totally agree. I think where I continue to struggle with the story is that if Austin really was trying, it's not successful to kind of punish these people for their turning a blind eye to what they're really living off of. Because they do, I mean, they all do still have choices, yet Mansfield Park doesn't divest from Antigua and they all just live happily ever after. I mean, Sir Thomas especially kind of just lives happily ever.
Yeah,
after.
He's like, oh man, yeah, it was really terrible. I did those horrible things.
Oh, yeah,
oh well.
Yeah.
Oh well.
He destroyed so many lives.
It could have ended some way else, but it didn't.
Yeah. Well, and he doesn't even try to like rehabilitate Mariah.
Yeah.
Which is something that I don't know. I mean, we're going to talk a lot more. Like, so I have some things to read, and like, we're going to talk about a lot more about how the amorphous, the shape of that is for, you know, in general, for the general layperson reader.
And I do want to talk about the things about the movie that we do like. We're doing these like really heavy themes kind of right here off the bat. But like I said, I actually, as a movie, I thought it was really good and I enjoyed watching it. I don't want people to think that I'm just like,
for me, as a movie, it fails. As an adaptation, it fails, because I always felt, let me go back and talk about the evolution of my relationship with this movie, right? In 1999, I was too young and dumb, right, to have picked up on the actual slavery subtext in Mansfield Park. So when I saw Rosanna's work, I was like, WTF, what is she doing? Why does this need to be here? I completely did not understand that it was really there, that this is important, that she's doing something revolutionary. Fully supported by Harvey Weinstein, by the way.
Oh my God. I was watching the movie. And the Weinstein names popped. I think I texted you and I was like, my God, this is a Miramax Weinstein movie.
He was 100% behind her. And it's so, he's like proud of the movie. And like, it's so weird to dig into all of this, but anyway, fully supported. And it's kind of crazy. I mean, I'm sitting here thinking, why did they think this would sell? Why did they think anyone wanted to see an Austin movie with this in it? This is sad. This is no fun. This is a down, you know, like, and they did something important. Rosanna did something important, and that credit should go to her. But yeah, at the time, okay. I was just furious, because I love this book. There's so much value here that we completely set aside if we only do the modernized slavery subtext, I'm Jane Austen avatar kind of a thing. Because the book itself is so good about intimate relationships and what selfishness looks like in real life and how we can ignore it. And yeah, that's selfishness on the large scale, but we miss selfishness on the small scale, because we were just shouting out loud lines like, your father's trying to sell me like one of his slaves and I'm going to go riot and gallop on a horse. I'm like, there's so many lines that land like a lead balloon. Mm-hmm. Even though she does use a lot of Austen's dialogue, which I was delighted about, that gets totally overshadowed by all the ham-fisted things she tries to do. But anyway, so that's how I felt about it at first. Later, I learned about the actual slavery subjects in Mansfield Park, which to me, there is no question. You might think one or two things might have been coincidental, whatever. Taking the preponderance of the evidence that is just very, very literal and in your face, it's there. I mean, it's there. And then I started to realize this was important to people. Like, seeing this was important. Rosanna wrote at the top of her script, this ain't no garden party, which it is and it isn't, right? Always in Austen. And that's the thing. She didn't portray it is and it isn't. She just went and did it isn't, which is fine. But you miss out on so many good, important, valuable, unique, extraordinary things about Mansfield Park when you don't have time because you've decided to focus on something else. And so it's always going to be the fate of the Hollywood adaptation. I don't know, but I grieve a lot of things that were lost in Lover's Vows.
But Kristen, you'll never be satisfied. Like, you're never.
No, but I will. I can.
Until you write the definitive. No. Until Kristen Whitman writes the definitive Mansfield Park adaptation. Will you ever be satisfied?
If this movie just had even a few scenes where we could have seen those sparks and those relationships and those dynamics develop. If it had an actual winning Mary Crawford instead of someone who's supposed to be this evil vixen who is harsh and not appealing, right, as Mary Crawford.
Disagree. You know me. I like Johnny any Mary Crawford.
Miller. Anyone but Johnny Lee Miller, please.
Johnny Lee Miller, perfectly fine.
And JLM one more freaking time in these.
Perfectly fine. Perfectly fine.
No, he was not.
His neck is not, cannot support a cravat.
Charisma, black, whole turd on the screen. Get him out. I hate his performance. And his character is written so wishy-washy as well. How could anybody want to be with this guy?
Isn't that a problem with Edmund? Isn't that also a problem with Edmond?
But that's the that's why you have to be good at writing and directing, because two women supposed to be head over heels in love with this guy. So why? That's what you got to find. That's what you got to portray.
If we're changing Fanny to Jane Austen, like, why can't we make Edmund more interesting?
Otherwise, no one believes in any of this. None of the story makes sense. Why are these women head over heels for this absolute douchebag? I mean, when Mrs. Norris tells Fanny, right, Fanny, go clean up the sewing from yesterday. And she's like, okay. Johnny Lee Miller's like, but Ed Norris, surely it could wait. And it's like, no. Like, no, like, this has to be better than this. You can't have him watch her treated this way. And I mean, like, Edmund has the moment in the book where he's like, Fanny must have a horse. He's concerned about her. Like, he does many, many things to actively help her. Whereas Johnny Lee Miller never gets that chance. Mm-hmm. He never appears attracted to, like, anybody. Why would Mary Crawford be attracted to him? Why would he be attracted to her? We are never shown these things. And so there's no emotional resonance whatsoever in the romantic subplots.
Yeah. And his neck is, like, not good for the cravat. It just doesn't look right.
Why are his lips so pink? Who was the makeup person? Why did he always have pink lipstick on? It's not mean. He's an attractive guy. Whoever was doing his makeup did him such a disservice. He always looked so weird. I don't know. It was so bad.
You know what, though? I will say, I do not have as big a problem with him as you do, obviously. And I thought the scene where they almost made out over, like, Tom's almost dead body, I think. Wasn't that right? Yeah, wasn't it like sitting on his... Anyway, I thought that was really hot.
That was actually really hot.
I rewound and watched it. I watched it multiple times.
Until the third viewing of this movie, because I was so checked out that I, like, stopped even watching their scenes.
No, I thought that scene was really hot from the beginning. I rewound it and watched it multiple times.
It is hot, actually. Yeah. It's surprisingly hot.
I like Mary Crawford as pansexual. I'm into it. I thought it was awesome.
Can I say, too, I never had my eyes open to the potential for a lesbian relationship between Fanny and Mary. And now it makes so much sense to me after this weekend, after, like, immersing myself in this movie. And before, I just thought it was like a cheeky ratings thing. And now I understand the potential. And I actually have in my notes, oh my God, it would be so interesting if this story was about their love story. And
there's definitely fanfic. There's got to be fanfic. Like, what better way to make Fanny, like, more interesting?
Right.
But also to, like, have her have, like, a flowering of personality and, like, recognizing of the world. And I just want to point out that I was really excited to see Anne Beth Davids play Mary Crawford, who I know as Natasha in Bridget Jones.
Oh, yeah. It's very exciting. I mean, I don't know if it was intentional, it was directing or whatever. She has a very haggard sort of appearance in this.
Oh my God, rude.
She does. I mean, it's makeup, it's styling, it's choices. I mean,
it's just possible that the lighting and makeup team were not all on the same page for this film. I mean, I thought the costumes were okay. I don't remember anything really, like, spectacular. So maybe we just didn't have, not to be, like, rude to any craftsmen, but, like, it sounds like there's multiple things that you noticed that really took you out of the film in that regard.
What were we even talking about? I'm sorry. I feel like I got us off on such a tangent.
You're talking about Mary Crawford. Okay. I would like to point out that this is probably the third time I've seen this movie. I never noticed that Lindsay Duncan plays two roles.
Oh, yeah.
I never noticed until this time that she plays Mrs. Price and Lady Bertram. Lady Bertram, is that right? She's Lady Bertram. Yeah. I think that's so genius. Because it's like a sliding doors type of thing. Like, one sister went this path, one sister went this path. And they make it very explicit later where she's like, Fanny, remember that I married for love. And I thought that was so smart. I really loved that decision. I don't know how you feel about it, but I thought it was great.
I that burst upon me very late too. And I thought it was extremely clever.
I think it just goes to show how transformative she is.
Yeah.
That I wasn't like, oh, that's the same person. Do you know what I mean? Because I know who she is. I recognize her.
Yeah.
But it just didn't. Shocking lack of pugs, though.
Shocking. That's right.
Definitely
they kept being referenced, but and they did this thing that they also did in the Billy Piper version where at the end she's like, oh, Fanny and Edmund are finally getting somewhere. I knew they were in love.
Oh, yeah. Like, she didn't give a shit. Come on. Did she not want that? She, like, wanted to shut it down from the very beginning. She did not want that to happen. They did not want that to happen.
Checked out. Well, she certainly wanted Fanny to marry Henry Crawford because she promises her a puppy.
Yeah.
From the next litter of pugs. Yeah. So it didn't make any sense. A lot of the stuff at the end was, it felt like very like tacked on, but
yeah. I do like the scene. You probably hate it, but I do like the scene where she and Edmund are sitting together and they find those crazy kids finally get together and he's like, Fanny, I love you. And she's like, I know. Oh, I liked it. I liked it. I won't apologize. I won't apologize for liking
you. You never have to apologize. Well, sometimes you have to apologize.
Tell me like about why it's important that Lover's Vow be included much more than it was.
Well,
please.
Lover's Vows is where the heart of the book is on display. And as you said, we never see Henry Crawford being slowly seducing Mariah in front of everybody's face.
We kind of see him like just like sidling up to her behind the scenes once.
We don't see him and Mariah and Julia shuffling around. Who's going to be Agatha? There are so many. And yes, you can make an argument that could be cut. Every individual detail of Lover's Vows could be cut, but they cut way too much. And so you don't distrust Henry Crawford. And then she's the one who's fickle because they decided to do this autobiographical. Austin also accepted a man for financial security and then rejected him the next day. But that the whole point of Fanny is her constancy. And then the story took that away. So when she's accusing him of being too changeable, now she's done the exact same thing. So I didn't really feel like she had a leg to stand on. And you kind of hate her for it.
Yeah.
You know, and
I think that's probably the biggest flaw of this adaptation. Everything.
Yeah. And I mean, with Edmund, you know, if you're going to have, I mean, Johnny Lee Miller, like if you're going to have a guy play a quiet, reserved guy, you have to get a charming, warm actor to do that and then rein it in, or it's not going to read on screen. Mm-hmm. Like that's why we all love Hugh Grant.
Exactly. That's a perfect example. Yeah.
Right. So Crawford gets a lot of powerful things. He's like, look at me again. You know, he's asking to be not just the rake. And it does ultimately, her accusation, he just wants to be loved. You know, he doesn't want to love. He probably saw himself as like this person who was elevating her and he would be loved forever because of that. That did ring true. But at that point, it was all just a mess and you didn't know how to feel. And now I'm just going through some notes, like because the emphasis on her family really, really needing help. You understand why she accepted and then rejected Henry Crawford, but that's Austin's story. That's not Fanny Price's story. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to say too, like, I can like this adaptation for the interesting things that it is doing. And now I do. And now I actually get very invested, but it's the Sir Thomas parts that I think are the most interesting. So the thing about Fanny is that even though I have many times said, are we even supposed to like Fanny? The fact is that, you know, soul searching this weekend, I do like Fanny. And I do think that Fanny is necessary to this story because Austin is saying something about emotional abuse of women, right, in this position. Mm-hmm. And when we look at Fanny as like milquetoast, we always overlook her strength. We also overlook the pain of, I don't know. So as you know, I was a child with a lot of social anxiety. I was always on the outside looking in. I was always wanting people to love me, but I didn't know how to connect with them. Like with Edmund, you know, just being obsessed with this person and they don't know, right? I was always like, she's trapped in her interior life and she didn't fit anywhere. And like for me, moving place to place, she had no real home. Like she's displaced, never felt like she had a home at Mansfield till she went back to Portsmouth, never felt she had a home there. She's between two worlds. She's emotionally neglected. She's abused. She's discarded. She's bullied. And she has this strength. She has to stand back and watch. Like we talked about in the making of Jane Austen, where that one illustrator had the illustration of her standing next to the tree and looking down way, way, way far away as Edmund and Mary on the horse. And it's just this emotional, right? And so it's seeing that and knowing a person is there watching people and those people's behavior, it comes to define her morality.
Right.
So she actually grows separate from Edmund by watching him and watching him relate to everybody else. And this person who was molding her, she actually grew the ability to make different decisions than him, to criticize what he was doing. And there's an inner growth and a strength there. And that's why you need to have Fanny to tell a real story of Mansfield Park.
Yeah, let me ask you a question, Kristen. Do you think because when I'm talking about like the first time you saw this movie before you kind of appreciated parts of it, do you think that because you connected so much with Fanny for the reasons you just said, that it felt like kind of a personal betrayal that they just completely changed who she was?
That sucked. There were a lot of betrayals for me, but I would say okay. That was the hardest betrayal because I just want someone to tell this story. This is an important.
Yeah. Like, why story. Do you have to completely change everything about the main character?
The idea of are people who act unfairly always bad? Is Mary Crawford a bad person? Is Sir Thomas?
I don't think the movie makes her a bad Well, okay, maybe the movie wants us to think she's a bad person. But first of all, I like the decision of having her kind of out herself to everyone with her kind of scheming sense at the end. Oh, see, I really liked it. But also, like, she's doing her thing and doing her little monologue, and I'm like nodding. I'm like, yes, this makes sense.
Me too.
This is a good plan. This is a good plan. You guys should listen to her. Like, she's going to fix everything. Because that's like how my brain works too. I always go into like fix it mode when something bad happens. And I also have like a touch of the Slytherin in me that like I can manipulate people in situations to often get what I want, but not like a nefarious way. But do you know what I mean? I hope that makes sense. Like if I want to do something, I can like pretty much usually get my way just based on the way you ask. Like you bring it up a couple times and then you can finagle it. But so when she's talking, I'm nodding. I'm like, yeah, this is a good plan. This makes sense. I know that I'm supposed to think she's deplorable, but like guys, this would work.
Yes, 100%.
And then we're still supposed to hate her.
Well, and that's why the movie's not successful. And I think any modern adaptation of Mansfield Park has to deal with that, how that practically appeals to us. I mean, these sins aren't what they once meant. And, you have to reckon with that. I think any successful adaptation would have to have Edmund breaking away from the Church of England. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's like the story is all there. How we wrap it up satisfying to a modern audience, that can change. And the themes and the heart of the book can still be present. And this left the crappy ending in and still eviscerated the heart of the book out of the movie. Yeah. And so for me, it fails on both fronts, you know?
I need to caveat my statement by saying I was on board with Mary Crawford's speech until she gets to the like, and since your brother will probably die part, I was like, okay, too far.
That was so stupid. She's too smart to say that.
Too far. You shouldn't like, I mean, this is literally their kid you're talking about. Mary, it's like when someone's doing an impression of the boss and then the boss walks in behind them and you're like, stop.
That's another reason why it didn't work is she's too smart. That character is too smart for that nonsense.
Yeah, she should have known that she couldn't push it that far.
And so there was so much unrealistic stuff about it. You know what? What almost would have felt the most organic thing of all is if Fanny had fallen in love with Tom for his deeply principled, feelings about what he saw in Antigua.
Well, yeah, except the fact that he like was drunk all the time.
Well, sure.
But it's James Purfoy. I mean, I'm just saying.
It's tragic.
I think he's very attractive.
yeah. He didn't have much to do, but yeah.
Well, this is 1999, baby. I think this is pre-Rome. He wasn't Mark Antony yet.
No, that's fine. And they tried to sort of retcon that character too with like Sir Thomas saying like, he always wanted a mission.
I liked that though. I liked that stuff. Tom for me, and he works if he's just kind of like, well, he's the first son, they're assholes. Like all he cares about is pleasure. Like it works for that. It's fine. I think it works. I thought this worked too. Like that was a change that I wasn't mad about. Any kind of nuance for people I'm generally in favor of. And I don't think the movie tried to make him you're supposed to understand his behavior, not forgive it. Does that make sense? I mean, he's in blackface. Like, you're not going to forgive him. But I understand why now. I understand the why.
I really like this decision that she made to have Tom. Of course, anyone seeing, like, a young man going to Antigua and seeing what he would have seen mm-hmm. would either react that way or become a party all the time guy, like the Bright Young Things after World War One, where it's like hedonism. And I think that's Tom in the book. I think that's actually what Austin was kind of trying to play, is this like very lazy gentry slave owning class that just played all day. But I thought it actually made perfect sense. But here we have a person who's actually taking a moral stand, as opposed to Edmund, who's just telling Fanny, yeah, we all live off the proceeds, pretty fucked up, right? And then doing nothing about it.
Okay. He's chastising her for not like recognizing where it comes from. And then he's like, isn't that really shitty?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go back to our castle.
again, why would anybody? Yeah. And I mean, I know that's how the book is supposed to make us feel too, but you know, anyway.
Maybe all you have to do is put in a line though. It's kind of like what I was saying earlier. All you have to do is put in a couple lines and be like, and I read like, this is the situation. It's awful. And we are powerless to change it. You know, like just have an acknowledgement that like he's thought about it or any of them have thought about it. And like, it hurts him that he can't do anything to change it, or he feels like he can't. Even something like that, I thought would have been gone a long way, because that's how I feel. You know, what can I do? I can learn about it. I can speak about it. I can give to organizations that try to fix it. But I mean, I can't rebuild the economy. And so just having characters acknowledge that, I think, would make us more understanding of them. We just need to write our own Mansfield Park, Kristen. There's nothing for it.
Ron Rosenbaum in the New York Observer wrote a reaction article to this movie that is called "Please, Miramax, Don't Call It Mansfield Park."
Oh, a reaction article.
Like I don't know if it's a review. I don't know if Ron Rosenbaum like was really
an op-ed.
Whatever. It's on the internet. I don't know. He starts up and he talks about how he describes people based on their favorite Austin novel. It's like, you know, he didn't say this, but like Emma. I would say Emma is for people with daddy issues. And I say
this
that.
This guy sounds like a laugh riot at parties, by the way.
From a place of that, right? But he describes Mansfield Park people as tormented souls with pleasure principle issues, because we are, that's what we're doing here, is we're just spinning our motors. Like, how do we reconcile all this? And he goes into, you know, he says he knows it doesn't even like Mansfield Park. I mean, it's the problem novel, right? But he still has come to appreciate it to the level of outrage with Patricia Rosamond's decision to replace Fanny and just make a Frankenstein Fanny, where she transplants a different personality into Fanny. He says, poor Fanny, disdained for her lack of dynamism by the director, in the same way the rich fools at Mansfield Park disdain her. Poor Fanny, she is just not interesting enough for Ms. Rosma. So she turned Fanny Price into a writer, a young woman boldly penning stories about life, love, and society. Quote, I made Fanny a writer as she is, in order to give her a more active inner life, she tells us in the production notes. It's another diss for poor Fanny. Not only didn't she have a cool creative career, but her inner life was lacking.
I can't get bent out of shape. I'm sorry, you're still reading. Go ahead.
This last is a real slander, because the one thing you can say about Fanny, like all Jane Austen heroines, is that she doesn't miss a trick. She sees and exquisitely registers everything. Registers it in a low-key, understated, but incredibly acute and eloquent way. As a matter of fact, rereading Mansfield Park this time, I came to appreciate Fanny's sly wit, her powerful, unvoiced, but not unfelt emotionality. Ms. Rosma is like one of the cool, popular girls in high school, condescendingly trying to make over a wallflower she thinks is just a drip, because she's too self-absorbed to tune into Fanny's wavelength.
Okay, he needs to calm down. I'm like rolling my eyes at the end of that. But see, I don't mind really replacing Fanny with Jane Austen, because I don't really like Fanny that much either. Apparently, that means I just like don't understand the book or whatever. But I'll just put it out there. Like, I don't think Fanny's that. I don't know how you make a movie a movie with a pure adaptation of Fanny and make it work for a modern audience. Maybe you can prove me wrong, Kristen.
I don't know how, as a bad director, you make a movie where you can't understand Fanny.
No, I'm sorry. I'm not trying to be too hard, but I'm just like, I'm still reading here. Fanny should have reacted to adversity like her. I keep thinking, Ms. Rosna tells us, if it had been me, that would drive me berserk. I wanted to bring the anger to the material, the anger that I have as a contemporary woman with a shocking capacity to control my own destiny.
Yes. So I don't mind, as I said before, like, I actually like and don't mind like what she did with Fanny to make her movie a success, right? I'm okay with it. But we just have to stop and say this falls short of an adaptation because this is not the movie Jane Austen was trying to tell. Ron Rosenbaum goes on to say, okay, Patricia Rosma. So suppose that the Weinsteins, in cutting your movie, it didn't test well with the audience, and they retcon Fanny into a completely different person, a sex-crazed Fanny, for example. How would you feel about that? Or is this only okay because Jane Austen is dead? Ooh. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? And so I think the Fanny lovers amongst us just have to get it out and say it. But I'm not saying that, you know, this is like, what am I saying? I'm saying I appreciate this directorial decision. I dig it. I can see it. I can understand it. It's interesting. But give me one with a real Fanny. I will be so happy if I could just have one with a real Fanny. You know what I mean? Or maybe, maybe 16 people listening to this are yelling like, read the book. Maybe want to read the book, which is also
like, and so my big problem with it was, like we said earlier, is that if you're going to make this Fanny awesome, like I think she's great, it doesn't bother me. But the other thing, specifically Henry Crawford, then don't support her choices.
Yeah.
He's fine. It's a fine choice. Girl, you go back and you're living, you go back to your mom's house and you've got five people in bed with you. I mean, Henry Crawford's great. It's just, I think that that's for me like a big issue with it. Because if you're going to set her up as like knowing her own mind, making these choices, having make these moral decisions, like you have to show that he's not worthy. And we just don't get that. And also, like you were saying, we have to show that Edmund is. Whatever, I still like that.
I wanted to, like, my whole thing here is, okay, so I needed, like, a really fast primer on the literature. I needed a literature review that would kind of tell me the evolution of our understanding of the Mansfield Park slavery subtext. And Arnie has actually written one on his blog, which I found extremely helpful. I'm not saying
Arnie.
But... you know, I'm not saying it's exhaustive, like, and I'm not, obviously you can go read it if you want. There are some other things that, other resources out there as well. You know, this is not a peer-reviewed publication, but I trust Arnie to do a lit review. He's an incredibly smart person and he really contextualizes it a lot. So I was going to read this. It's called Jane Austen's Dead Silence, The History of the Slavery Subtext in Mansfield Park. And it's on his blog, The Sharp Elves Society. For almost two centuries, Mansfield Park has been Jane Austen's problem novel in the sense that the term problem play is used to describe some of Shakespeare's plays. Like All's Well That Ends Well, Mansfield Park defies categorization as either comedy or tragedy. Both are love stories that seem to end well, but not decisively. Austen even flags this parallel by giving her irresolute male hero the surname Bertram from that play, just as for other reasons she also gives him the Shakespearean first name Edmund. Controversy among readers about Mansfield Park goes back a long way, but in recent years the perennial Fanny Wars have been upstaged by one major controversy: the existence and or meaning of what may be called the novel slavery subtext. This refers to oblique textual references to the real world of slavery and abolitionism, a social issue to which Jane Austen has long been thought by many to have been indifferent. That controversy has piqued the interest of many readers, but even one familiar with the novel would be hard-pressed to describe all its contours, let alone make an informed decision as to their opinion about it. The flurry of words written on the topic range of lay and scholarly, particularly feminist and post-colonialist perspectives during the past 15 years, is confusing and nearly impenetrable even to an Austen scholar. Ideology has further clouded matters because some have seized upon its controversial aspects and dismissed the entire subject as an ivory tower confabulation with little connection to the novel's text or meaning for most Austen readers. One can readily discern why this has happened. The stakes are high. The existence of significant and potentially disturbing slavery references in a novel by the author of widely cherished love stories is the hottest of buttons. Mm-hmm. It goes to the heart of the matter. What is Mansfield Park really about?
Arnie.
I think if I was just going to put a cherry on top of like this whole conversation, we will be talking about it forever. What is Mansfield Park really about? But
is that a good thing that we can't actually say?
Exactly. Is it a good thing or you know, it is to an extent. Okay, that has a place. We should have that conversation. Yes. But let's not also forget Mansfield Park is an absolute banger. I mean, it is a banger. It is such a good novel on the textual level.
Right.
You can have a hell of a good time making that, reading it and making it into a movie. And maybe we could also have that. But I am glad we have this. I am glad we have Rosma's adaptation.
Well, good. Well, Kristen, that's really good. I'm glad to hear you say that. That seems like a really, that's like a big step for you. I'm not being sarcastic. I mean it.
It is a big step.
So the thing, like, just to kind of go back to what you were just saying, like, it's really hard to say what it's about. Is that a good or a bad thing? My response to that, the question I asked, it's art.
Yeah.
To some people, that will be the best thing. To some people, that would be infuriating. Like, just tell me what it's about.
Yeah.
And then some people want to like write papers about what it's about and debate and discuss and think about it their entire lives. And that they're both right. Like, it's fine. Art is always subjective, right? And we can't know unless Austen was like, here's exactly what I was trying to do. That's why it's interesting. So I'm not sure where I fall on that spectrum really with it. I haven't engaged with it as much as you have. So I feel comfortable though, just kind of being like, that's art.
Yeah.
And that is actually good art.
That's showbiz, kid.
When people can engage with it from all these different perspectives, negative reaction to art is also valid. Some people don't like Mansfield Park at all. Like, that's valid to me. You may not agree that that's valid because you love it.
No, it's not valid. It's horseshit.
Okay.
They're not paying attention. They're not paying attention.
That biased opinion aside, I will say that I think that that's valid. Not everybody likes everything.
I don't know.
You can't be like, this is bad because I don't like it. Do you know what I'm saying? I think that is not a valid opinion. But to be like, I don't respond to this, it's not for me, is valid. And so it's interesting to apply that kind of framework to the movie. Like, is it a good movie?
Right,
we've pointed out a lot of flaws internal to the movie that kind of take it down a few pegs for me in terms of things not like holding together, characters not making consistent choices, the film itself not showing us enough about the people for their decisions to make sense. But I don't think it's bad.
If you don't like, at least like some parts of Mansfield Park, you don't like Jane Austen.
Well, and see, that's the thing. A lot of people, Kristen, don't, it's not that they don't like Jane Austen. They just can't penetrate the prose.
No.
As a modern reader, some modern readers would really struggle.
Sure, sure, sure.
As
long as you can understand the prose. If you read that entire book and there is not a moment where you're like, ah, pure Jane Austen right here. This is the stuff. Put it right in my veins. Okay, now I'm getting gatekeepy, so I'll just stop. I think this episode is going to be so weird to edit. I feel like I've gotten very shouty and that was not my intention at all.
No, that's the funny part. That's the part that people like.
I will try to make it not so shouty.
Well, we're both sort of all over the place. But again, like, that's a reaction to the material.
Yeah. Yeah.
And not just the book. Like, we're talking about the movie too.
Yeah.
Like, your reactions are, it's not one thing. I thought that scene in the bedroom was super hot. I thought it didn't
it is hot.
Any sense. I didn't think it made any sense that she doesn't want to go with Henry. You know what I mean? Can be true.
Right.
I would watch it again and then try to keep an eye out for more things. So I guess in like that, it is successful. I liked it. I would definitely watch it again. I think there's more things I could pick up on. But we still clearly don't have, on our quest for the definitive Mansfield Park, we're still desperately seeking Susan.
Yeah, we are. And that's okay. And we'll stay on this journey. And we'll, in the meantime, we'll just enjoy the book, and we'll enjoy this adaptation, and we'll enjoy great conversations about it. And
yeah. And I think we haven't said anything about, what is her name? The lead actress, Frances, what's her name?
Oh, Frances O'Connor.
She's great.
Yeah, she's great.
She's great. We haven't really talked about the actual performance. I thought everyone's fantastic. I know you don't like Johnny Lee Miller. That's been made very clear. But I thought the cast was fantastic. You got Hugh Bonneville. Come on.
Oh my God. Come
like,
on.
Everybody's in this movie. It's so funny watching this, like, 24 years after it came out. You're like, that's that guy. I feel like that Leonardo DiCaprio meme where he's like pointing at the screen. Like, I know that guy.
Yeah, it's that guy. Yeah. Harold Pinter as Sir Thomas was also outstanding.
Yeah, everyone was really great. It's not like it's one person. I mean, you would probably disagree with the director, but I feel like everyone really tried.
I don't even disagree with the director. I mean, I have incredible props for her, the research that she did, the risks she took. Mm-hmm. I do think maybe she should have given some extra thought to why, because she's on record. She's like, I don't like Fanny. I don't get why Austin would have written that character. And it's like, okay, well, if you're going
to, why are you making this movie?
If you're going to adapt it, maybe focus a little bit more, maybe have a few more conversations, maybe come to some peace with that. But you know, I have an incredible amount of respect for what she did here. And
make Lady Susan. Yeah. Like, why?
Yeah. Make Lady Susan. Yeah. Weinstein wanted a Mansfield Park, which.
Where? You know, so this is after Shakespeare in Love. So.
After Emma, too.
Yeah. I can't help but feel like they're still chasing that, like, Oscar high with, like, the costume drama. Well, it's not really a drama, but you know what I mean? Like, the costume romance. In fact, one of the IMDb trivias is that, like, one of the first trailers for this movie, they just took the music from Shakespeare in Love for the trailer.
Did they?
Mm-hmm. And you know what? I always forget that Ben Affleck is in Shakespeare in Love. Isn't that crazy? And he's funny. He's good.
He is?
Yes. He plays what's his name? The famous actor who has to basically, like, beg to be in the play.
Oh my God, I have no memory of this.
Okay, Google it. Google Ben Affleck Shakespeare in Love so you can see. Yeah, he's actually very good in it. And Ben Affleck, I feel like, was kind of a joke when he first started. People thought he was just like, not as good as Matt Damon, but I think that he's really become. Thank you for coming to my TED Talk. Today we'll be discussing how Ben Affleck is great. He's a really good actor, and I think he's a really good director. You know, he's just living that J-Lo life. Good for him.
Good for him.
Everything's coming up, Ben. This is a really weird place to go out on.
I would just say too, a lot of folks have had really important conversations in the recent past about Austin and kind of holding her to account of not being more vocal in support.
Oh my God, what do they want her abolition? To do?
Well, this is what I would just say. I think those conversations are important, but I would just say after we have those conversations, can we just take a second to turn inward? Because I have said this on Twitter, and I believe it. Like, if you're someone's fave 200 years from now, people will be asking them to justify why you were still eating beef and taking cross-country flights.
What I was saying. Like, we're all hypocrites, right?
Well, and so maybe what's useful about these conversations is, like, you've meditated on your purchasing habits, and maybe it's just good. These conversations mean something too, because we can stop and we can take a step back and we can say, you know, I have some intentionality in my hobbies, in my love of Jane Austen, I'm still going to think about these things. And when I'm done listening to my podcast or whatever, I am also going to bring that energy to my own life. And that's what we can and should do.
A lot of this reminds me too of, so one of my favorite movies is 1776, and there's some really good things in that. I was thinking about it earlier, actually, when there's a scene when they want Thomas Jefferson to take out a reference to slavery from the Declaration of Independence, or the South won't agree to basically break with England. And John Adams is like giving one of the guys a piece of his mind. And he's like, you're from New England. Where do you think all your money comes from? Like, you guys are practitioners of this too. Like, we're all profiting from it. And then another thing I was thinking of from that movie just now is John Adams says to Ben Franklin, he's like, posterity will, they'll never forgive us if we capitulate to this. In like hundreds of years, they'll be like, why didn't you stop this? How could you let this happen? And Ben Franklin says, what do they think we are? Demigods? Like, we're trying to do this one thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it says, I mean, this is a whole, we're not going to get into like the problematic founding fathers here. Like, that's not what I'm getting at. What I'm getting at is like, what do people want Jane Austen to do? She's like trying, she has no money. She's like writing when she can. She's a woman trying to get published. And like, what do they expect her to do? I just don't understand this at all. She's sick. She doesn't feel good. Like, they have no money. Right. Trying to hold this house together and her sister together. It's just like, think about how tired you are at the end of the day from working your job and having kids and your family and dealing with all this bullshit. And then it's like, okay, now it's time to like go, you know, it's up to you to end the climate change problem. I mean, what is it you want us to do? And Kristen, you make excellent point. Like, there are changes we can make. But it's also like, in 200 years, what would be your defense? Like, I'm tired. Guess who else was tired? Jane Austen. I mean, they didn't have ibuprofen, people. Can you imagine trying to get through this life without ibuprofen or Aleve? I mean, come on. I'm 43 and I get out of bed and I like my back and my knee, and like, imagine that, but you have nothing to help you. I'm just saying, that makes me really mad when people have that kind of like the critique, let's say criticism. That's not a critique. That is a criticism. And that just really bothers me. This idea that like you demand perfection like that from someone.
Yeah. So that was really funny. And I think maybe this is a good time, just looking at the clock and knowing you probably need to go to bed, to any last.
Yes, it is. It's 6 o'clock. It's time for me to go to bed. No, I'm kidding. It's later than that here. So we're recording later in the evening.
That Pacific Coast friend is just so annoying.
No, I suggested the time. I suggested the time because I wanted to make sure my son was in bed. Because trying to record if he's awake or in bed is a disaster. I'll just say I liked this movie. I mean, it sounds like from the end, you might think that we didn't, but I liked it. And I'm chuffed, Kristen, that you're coming around to it.
Oh, thank you.
And this is another one of those adaptations though, where you just kind of have to separate it from the source material, right?
Right.
Like how a lot of people can't do that. Well, talk about problematic Harry Potter, but like so many people were so angry with the movies.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's a different thing, guys. It's just a different thing. Inspired by, we'll put it that way. It's inspired by Mansfield Park.
Yes. We do have a wheat sheaf.
Oh, good. I was going to ask. We haven't been to the wheat sheaf in so long.
And that's my fault. But just wanted to thank LaDawn for her lovely note, new listener, and who is asking me about Sanditon. And I apologize, folks. I haven't watched season 3.
I did.
I don't know if I'm ever going to, but maybe we'll do a more Sanditon-y TV Sanditon podcast.
I thought season 3 was probably the strongest of all of them. Now, some people might disagree because they love Theo James, but like, I thought narratively it held together and was really good.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I was pleased. Okay. It felt satisfying ending.
Good. I'm glad. And even my dad is like, have you watched it? He's so cute. Yeah. I know his wife is into it. So now he's all into it. Yeah. So, okay. Well, should we sign off? Is there any last thing you wanted to tell?
I don't know. I feel like we need to end. Shouldn't there be like, don't we sometimes talk about things we're watching? I want to plug Hulu's Only Murders in the Building, which season 3 is coming, but we are almost done with season 1 and it's so fantastic. It's so great, guys. Everyone should watch it. It's really good.
We are rewatching New Girl, which has a
we did that
moments.
Too.
It has a few moments that are of its time, right? Where you're like, we wouldn't be saying this now, but his heart is in the right place and it's so funny.
I like the absurdity.
Yes. Yeah. And I love Nick Miller, right?
Jake. Oh, yeah, of course. And love I mean, him. Talk about like a character who actually shows real growth. Like, I think that he is really, I think that's a really, he's fantastically written. Faye had never seen it.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And we needed a show at lunch because we both work at home. We always want like a nice like 30-minute show, which is why we're watching Only Murders in the Building, also only 30 minutes. And so I suggested New Girl because I watched it as it aired and kind of dropped off towards the end. But we watched it and both really enjoyed it too.
And then the other thing is, any deckies out there watching Below Deck Sailing Yacht season 4, we have to talk. My mind is blown. Other than the original Below Deck season 3, this season of reality television is so crazy. Okay. I'm not even going to say anything. If you watch it,
you tried to get me to watch this. You tried to get me to watch this. I need to do it, don't I?
Oh my God. Well, if you have a lot of time to kill, yeah, you do.
But Kristen, what about me makes you think I have a lot of time to kill?
I know, but you know, if you ever did, then you need to watch it. It's just crap reality TV. You can.
Oh, but that's good. That's good. I mean, listen.
You can look at your phone while it's on.
Kristen, I am not judging. I watch every show The Bachelor puts out. Like, oh. I'm not up here. But that's because I discovered Game of Roses podcast where they gamify it, and they're like, "Hey, it's pro sports, baby," and I'm into that. So I watch it like that now, with that lens. Anyway, so there's some good. Oh, and I'm almost done with Queen Charlotte.
Oh yeah, I'm not gonna watch that one.
Oh, okay.
I have like an allergy to prequels. I don't like knowing what happens before if I already know where the character is now.
You know what? Usually I'm like that, but I'll say that the focus on Charlotte and Lady Agatha Danbury, I'm like really enjoying it. And they have stuff that happens in the like present Bridgerton storyline too. So it's not just like past stuff. They're advancing.
Oh, I see.
The main narrative.
I see.
For those characters. And so normally I would agree with you. I kind of reluctantly watched it where like Bay wasn't around and he had to watch something he's not interested in.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. So maybe problematic mental illness depictions, but I mean, they don't really know what was going on with him. So I recognize that it's difficult.
Yeah.
To know what was happening.
Yeah.
So anyway, Kristen, always a pleasure. How can people find us?
They can find us. Oh yeah. Our email address is first.impressions.podcast@gmail.com. We are on Twitter. I'm on Twitter as @firstimpresspod. And do you want to say your Twitter handle?
Sure. I will say that. I'll also say we do have a Facebook page.
Oh, yeah.
I usually use it for memes.
I don't even touch it. Maggie's the Facebook person.
Yeah, that's because like, I mean, oh God, Facebook, how old are you? Well, I'm 43, listener. Thank you very much for being judgy. But like most of my friends and family are on Facebook, so I do it. But I do share some pretty good Jane Austen memes that I find there. And I am on Twitter now. I'm at MaggieTweets3. And I have 90 followers now.
Oh, damn.
Practically influencer. Famous. I know, right?
But
I'll just point out that the First Impressions podcast Twitter is also your personal Twitter. So yes. Folks, there's good stuff on there.
Yeah. There's also like dumb, like, oh, it's raining in Portland. So
it's all good. It's all good.
I don't have time for a personal Twitter account and a Austin Twitter account. So it's all one Twitter account.
That's great. I love it. I never know what I'm going to get.
All righty. Do you want to sign us off?
Everyone, we have delighted you long enough.
Bye.
Bye.